Hi, I'm Cherry.
And I'm Morgan, and we host a true crime podcast, Crimepedia, where we investigate unsolved crimes and cold cases from across the world.
We work with law enforcement and victims' families to help spread the word about cases that need more help.
So join us every Tuesday wherever you download your podcasts.
And follow us on social media. Just search for Crimepedia.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Cold Vault. I'm your speaker, Casey, and for this instalment, I have a shorter-than-usual conversation with the amazing Dr. Clint Haycock. Disclaimer, this episode is more of a conversation than an interview, with discussions on some political topics. For more in-depth information or conversation with Dr. Haycock, please head over to the Mindshift podcast. Also, if you're interested in hearing more about cults and specifically Straightway, which I have covered a lot on this show, you can head over to Syria's amazing YouTube channel, Cults and Overcoming. I will post a link in the episode description for this channel. And for more from Ciaran Warner, investigative journalist following the body, who we had on the show a few weeks back, you can head over to the Frankie Files podcast, which is a slightly newer show with a hard-hitting perspective. I'll also add a link in the episode description. I can't tell you all how incredible CrimeCon in London was and the amazing opportunities that I've had since attending. I'd absolutely love the chance to meet some of you in Glasgow on September 10th. So head over to the crimecon.co.uk website today and use the code CULT to get 10% off of your tickets. After the US Supreme Court's decision today to end After the US Supreme Court's decision today to end the constitutional right to abortion, leaving this in the hands of each state to decide how they will handle abortion laws, with many states having trigger warnings in place to automatically make abortion illegal in around 22 of these states, this conversation is more important than ever. So here is Dr. Clint Haycock. So hello, Dr. Clint Haycock, and thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me today about this prevalent topic and your experiences with this subject. I have wanted to dive into this particular area of present day conditions for a long time, and I'm glad that I have an expert here to talk me through it all. So would you like to start by introducing yourself to the listeners?
Yes, thank you, Casey. So I host the Mindshift podcast. Like you say, I've been doing stuff on cult psychology and the religious right, dominion theology, Christian nationalism. To me, it's all kind of one big part and parcel. So I'm interested to talk about all this stuff with you today, for sure.
You have your show, the Mindshift podcast, and it covers all of those things that you've just mentioned. And on a week-to-week basis, the subject matter that you cover could change from one thing to the next around that particular subject.
That's true. I think it's a case of, I'm an academic. I love research and writing. And so I get into a subject myself and I research it for kind of my own, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, but my own interests and that kind of thing. Part of my journey of reconstruction after leaving the church, I was a Bible college teacher. I was a pastor for over 20 years. I came out of fundamentalism and evangelicalism. And then I got started into cult psychology and dominion theology. And I've started researching that. So what I try to do is I try to find experts in those fields, basically, ex-cultists, sociologists and psychologists and people who've done research and writing on those subjects. And so I'm absolutely fascinated to talk to people who know, you know, what they're talking about.
That sounds incredible. And one of the things that I'm really interested in learning about your journey specifically is that we mentioned before we hit record, we're in the same time zone and your work is predominantly around what is going on in other parts of the world, not specifically always where you're based and located. So do you find that that's just where the topics and the news and the media takes you most of the time? Or is it just because the subject matter that you're exploring is more prevalent in those parts of the world?
I think so. Yeah. So I'm, like you say, I'm living here in the UK. I've been in North Wales for years. We've been in the UK for about 16 years. I came over here to do a PhD at the University of Chester in Northwest England and just ended up staying on. So it turns out we're not even that far apart. You're not far from where I live now. So we're working on getting together at some point, aren't we? But yeah, that's the thing, is that you find North American religion and politics drive so much of the world. And even though a lot of this, yes, it's based in the United States and North America, it's spreading worldwide. And so I'm trying to educate people on what's going on, because it is driving politics and religion worldwide. I mean, for example, even this war in Ukraine right now with Putin and the Ukrainians, a lot of that has been driven by Christian nationalism. And so we see American evangelicals, they've been involved in Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union. You know, so there again is another example of how the tentacles have basically spread worldwide.
For anybody that isn't aware of what these things are and how they separate themselves from Christianity as an umbrella, can you kind of explain to myself and the listeners what dominionism is, Christian nationalism, and some definitions around some of the subject matter that you cover in your show?
Yes, I'll give you the thumbnail sketch. I just actually did this presentation, so it's fresh in my mind. I was presenting at the Court 2022, which is the Conference on Religious Trauma, just a few weeks ago. My good friend Jana Selby put that on again, and I was really fortunate to do a presentation on Christian involvement in politics and how that relates to religious trauma. So I went through Christian nationalism, dominion theology. So basically, dominion theology, a lot of it can be traced back to a certain guy called R.J. Rush Dooney, and he was a theologian. He was from Armenia originally, was born in the United States, but his parents were Armenian. And he came across with his parents right around World War I. They fled Armenia because of the persecution from the Turks. And he ended up in Southern California, and he founded a movement called Christian Reconstructionism in the 1950s and 1960s. And it's from R.J. Rush Dooney, really, that the first threads of what's called dominion theology can be traced, although you can find it in people like John Calvin and other people. You know, he put all the pieces together, basically. And the argument is from Genesis 1:26, which is the mandate, I guess you could say, in the text of the book of Genesis, when God is talking to the humans that he's created. And he says, you know, let us make man in our image, let them have dominion over the earth. And a lot of Christians, for basically since the beginning of Christianity, they've interpreted that from like an environmental stewardship point of view. But Rush Dooney looked at it and he said, no, this is a political thing. Christians need to take political dominion over the world, over the earth. And that's what this mandate really means. And from that, you can trace various streams or iterations. And the way it relates to Christian nationalism, as I see it, Christian nationalism is the belief, certainly in America, that America was founded as an expressly Christian nation, and it should become one again. So basically, dominion theology plays into that narrative. And you could say, well, if you're a Christian nationalist, the best way for us to turn America into a Christian nation again is to take dominion over the government, over the media, over religion, education, arts and entertainment, all these various spheres of society. Once we do all that, then America will become a Christian nation again. So the two really are part and parcel of the same kind of mindset.
There's so many things in what you've said that are spinning around in my mind right now in terms of some of the things that I've covered on the show recently. And it might be different for the listeners because, of course, with the backlog of episodes that I have, discussions that I'm referencing in my mind might not be released for another 6 to 8 weeks. But there's so much going on in America and the world that makes me think of lots of different things that apply to what you've just said, even down to things like British nationalism that we've been talking about a bit on the show as well, with some other Christian sects and branches that now exist in America that use a lot of those types of references that people have spoken about on the show. And then I was thinking about when you talked about your reconstruction after your deconstruction, that for you must have been such a different journey to what some other people's deconstructions look like, because you're now looking at biblical references and scripture again and turning it on its head in a different way to how you must have perceived it years ago and taught it as a Bible college teacher, and now looking at it from sort of like how other people have used that scripture for political and for cultural purposes, which is just, that's like so many different layers to, I mean, what has that been like for you?
Well, I think my doctoral studies really kind of started me on that journey academically, because as you say, one of the things about biblical studies, what you should do, even as an evangelical, I was taught that you need to, when you're talking about a particular interpretation of a biblical passage or a book in the Bible, you should look at it from the historical interpretation point of view. So in other words, how has that text been interpreted historically throughout the centuries, throughout the millennia? And when you compare those interpretations, you find that it's been, a lot of cases, radically different. You get completely different interpretations from the exact same text in different Christian and Jewish traditions. So I did that, for example, I did my studies on the book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament. And part of that was to go through and look at the history of Ezekiel interpretation. And that opened my eyes to a lot of different traditions that as a Bible college student, I'd been kind of sheltered from, because I was only given, of course, the one sort of fundamentalist evangelical point of view. So you should do that no matter what you're studying or researching. You need to look at multiple points of view.
It's so fascinating. I mean, how did you, when you first started to come across these other interpretations that were radically different from what you'd been taught and what you'd gone on to teach, what was your reaction to some of these different kind of interpretations that you were coming across?
Well, it was unsettling in the sense that, like I say, I was always kind of given this sheltered view. And I was raised in a pretty fundamentalist, narrow sect of Christianity. And I was always taught, you know, basically like the book that bears the author's name, that's who wrote it. You know, so Jonah wrote the book of Jonah, Ezekiel wrote the book of Ezekiel, Isaiah wrote the book of Isaiah, Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. And it was when I started getting into higher education that I realized, actually, no, these books are made up of multiple sources. They were stitched together by later editors and redactors. And what you find is when you look at the history of the interpretation, they've had to wrestle with those kind of issues. So that started me to deconstruct it, because I thought, wait a minute, this doesn't fit my narrow view of sort of inspiration and inerrancy, where the Bible is completely without error. There's too many factors that enter into the equation to sustain that sort of argument.
Of course, there are different versions of the Sure. Bible as well, which again must have been all of that you've just said just repeating itself from one version of the Bible to the next.
Yeah, and you can find that every different translation has a different agenda to it. There's different biases, there's different reasons for why that translation was commissioned in the first place. I mean, going back to the King James Bible, as we know, 1611, King James had a political and religious agenda behind that version of the Bible in English, you know, so it's nothing new in Christianity for sure that you've had different translations and different sort of histories. And then you go back to even further, there's different manuscript traditions. It's made up, you know, it was copied in different centers, different parts of the world, you know, so wow. It becomes a real deep rabbit hole that it's hard to sustain a very narrow fundamentalist, you know, view of the Bible for sure. And once you start to unravel that, then you start to question, in my case, the God who was behind it, you know, because I was always taught that the Bible was true, it was inerrant, it was without error, and God himself guaranteed that because he always speaks the truth. He cannot lie. Well, once you start to unpick that, you go, wait a minute, what's the God of the Bible doing that he's not preserving his word, you know, without error and all the rest of it? And that leads you down all sorts of, you know, rabbit trails.
And leads you to speaking at a conference around religious trauma and spiritual abuse, exactly. Which is inevitable, surely, when you're raised to believe that this is everything and it's true. And then to realize mm-hmm. that everything in your life that you'd, because surely then you question everything, everything you've ever held as 100% fact, and you know that it, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, where do you start to, where does it end in terms of, well, if that's not true, then what about all of these other things that I have in my belief system outside of religion? I can't, my mind is just spiraling with all
the mind reels, as I say.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because it's all down to identity and your sort of personality. Everything's wrapped up in that package. In my case, I was born into it. I was raised in it. So my identity was only ever the religious identity. I didn't have a pre-religious identity. So if you look at it from a cult psychology point of view, you think, okay, so cults, if you join a cult after you've been, you know, let's say you're an adult, you join a group and then you get into the religion and then you leave it behind. At least you had a pre-cult or pre-religion identity. In my case, people like me who were born into it, we didn't have a pre-religious identity. That's all we ever had. So when we walk away from it, it's even more devastating because you've got to then completely recreate, who am I? What is this person? Who is this person? Who do I want to be? And that's a whole different journey.
Especially for people from high demand religious groups that find themselves completely on their own if they do decide to take that leap and travel down that path, which of course we've covered a lot on our respective platforms, talking about things that the consequences of leaving high demand religious groups, and arguably might be one of the reasons a group finds itself labeled a high demand religious group in the first place. And one of the things that you mentioned about finding it unsettling to realize that there were multiple interpretations of the same texts that you'd come to know probably off the back of your hand. Were there any particular interpretations that you read and thought, well, that sounds plausible? Because I feel like all the interpretations are so clever in the way that they can explain themselves, that to read multiple things that either any of them could be the correct interpretation, it's like cognitive dissonance in multiple facets instead of just two ideas fighting amongst themselves.
Well, it's true. I remember something that actually a Canadian theologian, Dr. Stanley Grenz, he was an evangelical, but he said something that really sticks with me. He said something like, all theology is historically and culturally conditioned. In other words, if you look at every sort of theological time frame where they came up with big pronouncements or catechisms or statements of faith or whatever, those are all driven by a certain historical context. And you find that with scriptural interpretations as well, that I would say most, if not all, scriptural interpretations are also historically and culturally conditioned. So what I found out, for example, in the book of Ezekiel, was that when I looked at different preachers, you look at Jonathan Edwards in the 18th century in North America, well, what was a British colony then? And then I looked at Charles Spurgeon, and then a guy from Chuck Smith, who's the founder of Calvary Chapel in the 20th century, they all interpreted the same passage in the book of Ezekiel, totally different emphases, totally different, you know, points of view. And they're really hammering on issues that were relevant in their day and time. And that's what you find, is it was all historically and culturally conditioned. What bothered Jonathan Edwards doesn't even, you know, Chuck Smith in the 20th century doesn't even mention it, you know? So it shows how conditioned they are by their historical context.
And that kind of leads me nicely onto one of the things I'd written on our question sheet. And it says that on your website, it's written that to understand politics and cult psychology, we need to understand and assess the current conditions of the world. So if they're really pushing in sort of their generation, what is prevalent at the time, it leads us to having discussions around extreme evangelicalism, Trumpism, and Christian nationalism. Do you feel like Trumpism is still a thing, even though he has, as a figure, kind of disappeared slightly since his removal from the White House?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as we know, he's still a major figure. I guess you could say he's still the leader of the Republican Party, whatever that means. I think it's become basically the cult of Trump, which certainly it became during his presidency. If you've read that book, The Cult of Trump by Stephen Hassan, I mean, he goes into the whole thing, breaks it all down, how it works and how it still is working. And that's the fascinating part, is that when you look at the evangelical support for Trump, what's happening now is that they are basically, well, these groups are using the big lie that Trump lost the election because it was rigged and stolen and Biden shouldn't have been the rightful president, blah, 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 blah. They're now using that to motivate their base to vote for their preferred candidates. And of course, ultimately Trump, if he runs again in 2024. So they're actually using the big lie. That's the next iteration of the new movement in evangelicalism. So it's absolutely a thing. They're doubling down on it. And then there's a lot of these prophets who supposedly prophesied that Trump was going to win in 2020. And then when he didn't win, they said, well, actually, no, our prophecies weren't wrong. Trump did win and it was stolen from him. So we were right all along. And now we're even more outraged because we were right and it was stolen and God wasn't proven to be a liar. And I'm not a false prophet. And so it's just one toxic mess now.
Where does it end at that point? And where can you have a rational conversation with anybody that kind of adopts those values and that belief system, which is quite terrifying, really. Of course, anybody that listens to the show kind of knows that I probably lean to the left and more towards kind of, you know, equal rights for individuals. And the thing that I'm kind of recognizing from my perspective is that as Christianity is almost like an umbrella for many different things that we discuss on the show, various sects that break off from one another and perhaps get more extreme and radical as they kind of filter down, it feels like Trump, it almost is his own umbrella now as a cult of personality with various cults branching off of that. So you've got kind of the evangelicalism that we see, but it's hard as well because they all seem to kind of merge or blur into one another from time to time with like the Make America Great Again campaign and QAnon and Trumpism. And it's difficult to see the groups as separate things, but also to recognize that they are at the same time, if that makes any sense to you, Clint.
It does. And I think that's why the January 6th insurrection was such a pivotal event, because all those things you just mentioned and more all came together in that one day on January 6th, because you had Christian nationalists that had placards and signs and waving Bibles and, you know, Jesus saves and Trump is our, you know, savior and all the rest of it. Then you had that blended with QAnon. So you had that going on, but you also had these far right militia groups like the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the One Percenters, or the Three Percenters, or whatever they are. And they all came together under that umbrella of Trumpism to try and, you know, overturn the election results. And that's when it all sort of came together.
Yeah, so perhaps that's something for my own cloudiness around the subject. Perhaps that day, something has stuck in my mind where I'm like, why are all of these groups in my mind the same thing, but also not? And maybe it's that event. But I imagine that individuals that are going with these groups probably do align themselves with other beliefs from the other people that were present at that day as well. It's all very strange.
That's it. Well, but what I was going to say, if you read Sarah Posner's book, Unholy, she talks about the thing that's unique during the Trump era was the marriage between the Christian right and the alt-right. That's one piece of the puzzle. And she puts it all together in her book. And it's really a fascinating, if not disturbing, study. Because basically what happened is these forces came together to support Trump. So you see militia groups with, you know, crosses and Christian flags and everything else. And they all see this as one part and parcel of, we need to work together for the greater good, in air quotes, as they would see it. And so that's why the January 6th thing was such an important date, because you see all these movements coming together under that one umbrella, as you say, of the sort of Trump cult, the MAGA cult.
And I suppose the bolstering and the encouragement and the enabling that comes with all of those idealisms in one place is a quite a dangerous thing, considering that there are radical extremist views held by members of those particular groups, and also the policies around firearms and things that exist in America that we don't have over here. There are still guns around in, you know, we were just talking about Liverpool before, gangs and drugs and the criminal underbelly in Liverpool is something that people probably know about. I still argue that Liverpool is one of the most beautiful and welcoming cities in the entire world, and that there is a criminal underbelly wherever you go. But that I feel like it's not something, of course, as prevalent over here as it is over in America. When we start to talk about the potential for offline harm, and it kind of feels almost as if that's where some of these rallies are heading, and it's really scary to watch from over here. So I can't imagine how it feels for people that are actually existing in those environments.
Well, that's something we saw during the Obama presidency. I saw a graph a couple of years ago that was quite shocking, and that was all about how during the Obama presidency, far-right militia groups just shot up in terms of numbers and, you know, size. And this was something, a kind of a phenomenon. There've always been militia groups in America, but my God, I mean, they just spiked during the Obama presidency. And a lot of this relates to conspiracy theories, you know, birtherism, the fact that he was African-American, and there was a lot of underbelly of racism in America. As you say, when you combine that with guns, this kind of strong libertarian streak where, you know, we don't want the government telling us what to do. They're not going to take away our guns. I mean, every time there's a mass shooting, anyone starts talking about putting in insane gun control laws, the backlash is just incredible. Gun sales spike and ammunition sales spike in America after a mass shooting. And this is a phenomenon that's been going on for decades now. It's absolutely crazy.
It's hard to pull those things apart as well, because then when you're speaking about all of that, in my mind, I'm thinking there's clearly a promoted divide, an us versus them divide, whether that's around race and ethnicity, which has historically been an issue that I feel is more prominent in America than other places of the world. And then there's the us versus them encouraged divide between pro and anti firearm, which is again only going to help firearm businesses and gun stores and all of that sort of thing. But then I feel like I'm feeding into that conspiracy theory narrative myself, because that's the almost justification that a lot of extremists might use to adopt that type of behavior in the first place. So how do you separate yourself from that, and how do you make sure that you're not just adding to the problem by saying, well, my conspiracy theories sound more correct and more person-centered than yours do, so I'm probably the one that's right. How do you separate yourself from that and stop yourself from going down those rabbit holes yourself?
It's so hard. This is something that I was reminded of recently. I just went through Jen Senko's book, The Brainwashing of My Dad. I don't know if you've read that book, but I'm actually booking her on as a guest here in a couple of weeks, which I'm really fascinated. I love the book. And I wasn't prepared for the sort of in-depth detail that she went into when she talked about the growth of the far-right media in America, which is something we don't really have in this country, do we? We don't have people like Rush Limbaugh and these, you know, Alex Jones and Glenn Beck and people like that. They're increasingly far-right conspiracy theories and ranting and railing against the liberals, the libtards, the feminazis, as Rush Limbaugh used to call them. And it reminded me that it's this constant drip tap of just outrage and anger and fueling that sort of, you know, like you say, that dark underbelly of American society on the radio, on media, Fox News and One American News Network and these far right, increasingly these new quote unquote news networks. And they fed into that. And it's really difficult with the advent of the internet, because you can believe it's confirmation bias. You can believe whatever you want to believe, and you can go out and find, quote, evidence to support that belief. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really difficult increasingly now to find the truth, as it were, about whatever subject you're talking about, because you can find anybody who'll tell you what you want to believe. And they call that, you know, doing research about like the COVID pandemic and everything else and anti-vaxxers and all the rest of it. I mean, there's so much misinformation and disinformation flying around out there. It's really, really difficult to get at the truth on the internet. It really is hard, isn't it?
It's difficult as well if you feel kind of maybe like an outcast, or that you can't mm-hmm. find a specific community group in real life that shares your values and ideals. But it's guaranteed that somewhere on the internet, there will be a space that caters for your exact like niche interests, mm-hmm. Kinks, quirks, whatever it may be. You're sure to find that community. And of course, absolutely. With that, there's the potential for love bombing. And then, of course, then straight away, we're into that territory of undue influence and potential coercion and manipulation. Kind of going back to something that you mentioned about the cult of Trump, there's a big section in that book where Steve Hassan talks about disenchantment at the turn of the century that led to a lot of these new religious movements and high demand religious groups to actually crop up and exist and take advantage of a lot of the young people in places like America. And we saw that again in the 60s and 70s in a lot of the groups that we talk about on the show today. I think that's the Jesus movement. Is that the right thing to reference?
That's certainly one part of it. Yeah, the hippie movement that came out of that in the 60s and 70s. Yeah, a lot of these hippies that got evangelized and like they didn't cut their hair. They wanted to play rock and roll music. That's where a lot of the Christian contemporary worship music comes out of, is that time period as well.
So we can kind of trace groups like the Children of God or the Family International back to those periods of time. And we can look at how a lot of the same belief systems and values were taken and applied to a lot of the youth of that time who were going through these motions of, you know, leaving home and trying to go in search of something bigger than themselves. And a lot of people that I've spoken to on the show, I remember the author of Cultish, Amanda Montell, said this when I spoke to her, that we are ripe. I think that Yanya said this as well, like we are currently ripe for that to happen again. Exactly what Hassan talked about happening at the turn of the century. And then again in the 60s and 70s, it feels like we're right on that precipice where, or perhaps even right into it now, if we consider QAnon, where people are fed up with the mistrust they feel for the government, the state of the economy in the world. If you throw the pandemic in there as well, which even without that, this could probably all still be happening. It's almost as if people are in a place where if somebody comes to them with solutions and ideas and promises of the truth that could fix all of the discontent that we feel about all of these things, that we might just be swooped up into it.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Amanda Montell, because I just finished going through her book Cultish, and that was off the back of Jen Senko's The Brainwashing of My Dad. And I thought there was a lot of overlap between those two books, because okay, Jen Senko lays out the foundation for the far right media and people like Rush Limbaugh and Alex Jones and these really far right conspiracy theory, you know, people that push these things on far right media in America. But then Amanda Montell, she talks about, you know, how cults take advantage of people, as you say. And you think about that, how Trump, for example, was able to do that. He comes along in 2015, 2016. There's a lot of outrage and there's, you know, people in the Midwest, they've lost their jobs. Yet they've been taken advantage of by decades of policies that went against them. But he was able to feed into that outrage and the anger and the resentment. It's all about grievance politics, as you say. And he tapped into that resentment and rage of his base. And he just fed that the whole 4 years of his presidency. And people like Rush Limbaugh had been feeding that for decades before. So this is nothing new. He comes along at just the right time, taps into that outrage and resentment and anger. And so, yeah, a political cult of personality, you know, gets off the ground, and look at where we're at today.
My understanding of a lot of religious groups, as some don't vote, some don't take part in politics. So how is it that there is all of a sudden such a big merge between those two things and such an agenda that combines those two things together?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a sudden thing, because you have to look at the history of where the Christian right came from in America. And it's a long story. We don't have to go into all the details, but a lot of it can be traced back to when Jimmy Carter was elected president in 1976. And that was voted by Newsweek magazine. The story was 1976 is the year of the evangelical. Most people in America didn't even know what an evangelical was. And they realized there's this huge voting block, potential voting block, I should say, just sitting there that needs to be tapped into. And that was the basis of the organizers of the early Christian right that said, wait a minute, we need to tap into that block. That could become a giant Republican base. And that's really the base that ultimately would become the Trump base. It was nothing new. That base has already been there for decades. They were tapped into to vote Reagan into office and George W. Bush. And, you know, so these people were being, I guess you could say, manipulated by the people at the top. The you know, guy like Paul Weyrich, for example, he was a big name because a lot of people had never heard of him, but he helped organize things like the Heritage Foundation. He helped Jerry Falwell, come together and put together the Moral Majority in 1979. So he was responsible for a lot of these think tanks and organizations that would ultimately become sort of the basis of the Christian right way back in the 70s and 80s. So this has been a long time coming. It's not a new thing by any stretch.
I would like to speak to you about you as an individual, Clint, if that's okay.
Sure.
So,
yeah, absolutely.
Which church was it that you were a minister for?
Well, it was a non-denominational church in Portland, Oregon. So I was just the drummer on the worship team. I was going to Bible college at the time in the early 1990s, late 80s, early 90s. And I just got a gig as the drummer on the worship team. It's just a community church sort of thing. It wasn't part of wasn't a denomination. And I just stayed on probably longer than I should have. You know, I stayed there for 12 years. I ended up becoming an elder, then the head elder, then the senior pastor after 12 years. So I was there a lot longer than I originally intended, for sure. I was just going to play drums, you know, on the worship team. That was it.
Is that something you still participate in now, even after your journey through deconstruction?
You mean playing on worship teams?
drumming and music.
I still play the drums here in North Wales. I played in a couple different bands, but I'm into like heavy rock and blues. So I play in pubs and clubs all over basically North Wales, the Northwest area.
I mean, you're in a great part of the world to do that sort of thing. Yeah. When you talk about cozy pubs and live music, I feel like that makes me want to go and sit down for a beer right now, actually.
I would love to have a pint. We've got some gigs coming up. So it might not be too far for you, so I'll let you know.
Absolutely. You can come watch us play. I think we're probably actually only like 30 minutes away, which is wild, true. We're very close. When we talk about, you know, yeah, individuals all over the world that we've had the opportunity to speak with. But you've given us a little bit of information around how, when, and why you became involved in your church. And was it through your family's influence that you stayed on, or was it just through these extra responsibilities and roles that you found yourself in that you continued your journey into becoming a minister for your own congregation?
Well, I think at the time when I was growing up, I would say, I wanted to be a pastor. I wanted to be a teacher because that's how I'm wired. I'm a teacher. I've always been teaching some subject, whether it's the Bible, or now I teach, you know, carpentry and multi-skills to military veterans. you know, that's what I do for a living. It has nothing to do with religion at all. And yet I think now, though, looking back on it, I experienced a lot of religious trauma growing up as a kid in a very fundamentalist home. I say now I was raised in a cult. I was raised in a cult where my parents followed a guy called Bill Gothard, the Institute and Basic Life Principles. I'm sure you've heard of Bill Gothard. He used to be called the Institute and Basic Youth Conflict when I was a kid back in the 70s. And it was very strict, very fundamentalist. I think it was a cult, absolutely. And I experienced a lot of religious trauma. And I think I wanted to become a pastor and a Bible college teacher to help people avoid some of the pitfalls and issues that I fell into when I was a young kid. And I think that was a lot of my motivation at the time, even though I didn't realize it. But I see now I think that's what I was doing. Even unconsciously, I was trying to help people avoid that religious trauma, although I wouldn't have seen it like religious trauma at the time. But now, I mean, it absolutely was. I've had a lot of, you know, therapy and counseling around that issue to help come through all that and avoid being triggered and everything else.
That sounds like an incredible journey. And it's interesting that this is the experience that you've had, because the episode that I released just 2 days ago was an interview with Heather Grace Heath, who has penned the book Lovingly Abused about her time in the Advanced Training Institute growing up. And a lot of her work is around legal educational neglect. And actually, as of today, somebody sent me a video to show me that the Bill Gothard website is down and no longer live. And the Advanced Training Institute website appears to not be taking on any more participants, although you can still access the wisdom booklets that were the entire educational program. So it feels like this happens a lot, but it feels like things are coming full circle with the conversation that I'm having with you today. And it's really amazing how our brains, even under such strain and duress, can give us these signs and signals that perhaps there is something not quite right, or something that your brain wants to process on another level that you're not able to do at that time. And you saying that maybe that's always what you were trying to do without realizing it, in terms of your deconstruction and teaching others around the experiences that you've had to stop them from having those same experiences. That's really such an interesting thing to consider about our brains and how they work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the whole piece about education, as we know, one of the biggest ways, the best ways you can recover from a cult or controlling religion is to educate yourself on the psychology, the tactics that were used on you, the sort of historical milieu that led to the religion or belief system that you were a part of. So, you know, I mentioned earlier, we talked about R.J. Rush Dooney. He was the father of Christian Reconstructionism. One of the interesting things I learned about Rush Dooney was he was one of the pioneering leaders in the early Christian school and homeschooling movement back in the 70s and 80s. So even as a child growing up in the context of Christian schools and the home, I wasn't homeschooled, but I know a lot of people who were, like you're talking about. And part of the Bill Gothard thing was the ATI, which is a homeschooling arm of his cult. That all was started by R.J. Rush Dooney, and that was all the Dominionist angle. The reason Rush Dooney wanted to push Christian homeschooling so much and why he was a pioneer was because he believed that generations of children needed to be raised with this Dominionist, you know, sort of biblical worldview in air quotes, and eventually there'll be enough of them whereby they would take dominion over the world. So that was his sort of philosophy of education. So all of this stuff about Christian homeschooling, it all traces its roots back to guys like R.J. Rush Dooney back in the 70s in the early Christian homeschooling movement. So that's where I think the education piece, you start to put those pieces of the puzzle together and you go, aha, I can locate myself in this historical movement. And I was manipulated, I was controlled, you know, in this system.
That is absolutely fascinating in terms of what is currently going on in the world as we are having this conversation. And that is one of the questions on the list. And I'm just quickly scribbling notes so that we can talk about this in a second. But in order for us to have this conversation today, things took a significant change in trajectory for you and your life. And you talked a bit about higher education. Is that kind of how, why and when you left your position as minister? Or what did that journey look like for you in terms of realizing that maybe there was a big change in your life on its way?
Well, it was a big change in the sense that when we came over here to the UK, I'd come off the back of a traumatic experience. Like I mentioned, I used to be a pastor of a church in Portland for 12 years. The last several years were very traumatic. The church ended up actually closing down. We closed the church because it was headed to what looked to be like a very ugly church split. So we kind of proactively closed it down. We shut everything down. And of course, I was blamed for everything. You know, it was my fault. I was behind the whole thing like a puppet master pulling the strings, which none of which is true. But after that, I came over here with my family and I wanted a major life change and I wanted to get back into academics. I wanted to get out of pastoral ministry. So I spent another 7 or 8 years teaching and going to the University of Chester to do my doctorate. And I kind of, that was my sort of last gasp. My thought was, well, I want to teach men and women to become pastors like I was, again, to avoid the pitfalls of ministry and the trials and tribulations, because I've been in the trenches for 12 years. I knew what it was like to be a full-time minister. It's very difficult. It's a super thankless, tiring, exhausting job, or it can be for sure. So again, I was trying to sort of head things off at the pass. But the problem was I was deconstructing my beliefs at the same time. And that got me into trouble, you know, with not only my students, but also the school I was teaching at, because of course I was asking all kinds of questions about the Bible and they didn't know what to do with that. And they were like accusing me of being a troublemaker. And so eventually they were kind of glad to see me go, I think, in the end as well. And I needed to get out. That was the best thing they ever did for me, was make me redundant, which is, you know, basically being laid off, which is what happened to me in the end.
Throwing the pot, causing too many ripples.
It was becoming a problem.
I guess that's one of the main reasons why further education is such a difficult thing for people in high demand religious groups to have access to, or to have encouragement for, permission for, whichever phrase you want to use, whichever the individual circumstances are. It's not always something that's condoned for people within high demand religious groups because of these particular experiences where people have access to this level of secular information or other.
Absolutely. And if you come out of fundamentalism like I did, the basic orientation is you have to believe all the right things, like you say, to get into heaven. So I always had this kind of imaginary scenario where, you know, a person dies, goes to the pearly gates, here's St. Peter. You know, and St. Peter's asking him, well, what did you believe when you were still on earth? You know, and you run through the list of everything you believe. And St. Peter says, well, I'm sorry, you had it wrong. You didn't believe all the correct things. Sorry, you can't come into heaven. You're going to hell. But that's basically the scenario, isn't it? Like, this is that important that you get it right 100%. And if you start to unravel and unpick those things, man, I can remember being shouted at by a professor in seminary over questioning some biblical interpretations that really offended him. You know, he was screaming at me in his office, and that's how high the stakes were, that you had to get it right, you know? So that was another traumatic experience for me.
So you kind of get fired from that position that you're in, and your journey just continues. You just continue unraveling everything and deconstructing things piece by piece, and then taking that further education to the next level of educating others around everything you're learning about. Would you say that's kind of how things worked out?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, like I said before, my love is to do research. I love to write. I write articles on Medium and my own website. And doing the podcast is exactly what you said, because originally it started out, it wasn't called the Mind Shift Podcast. It was actually called the Preacher's Forum Podcast. We talked about this on an email, I think, a while ago. And the idea then was sort of my last gasp of progressive Christianity. Again, I was trying to help the church, you know, reform itself from within. And I was going to be that lone voice that says, hey, you know, we need to figure this stuff out and get it right because we're totally irrelevant. The world isn't listening anymore and blah, blah, blah. And so I launched this podcast originally with that kind of aim in mind. So I was talking to a lot of progressive Christians and trying to, you know, kind of come at it with this progressive angle. But as time went on, I realized that I didn't believe that stuff as much anymore. So someone said to me, well, actually, you're kind of deconstructing sort of live on air, as it were. And as the time went on, I realized that the name of the podcast didn't fit that title anymore. So that's when I changed it to the Mind Shift Podcast about, I don't know, 4.5 years ago, 5 years ago, because I thought, I can't do this. I'm not a preacher anymore. And like I said, I use my education to educate not only myself and the research abilities, but to help other people sort of rebuild their lives after leaving religion or any sort of controlling group behind.
Interestingly, something you said about speaking to progressive Christians about trying to work out, you know, what is right and where should we really be looking or directing ourselves? I feel like that had it, the potential to become its own movement in itself almost. You know, you're getting a group of people together who are trying to come up with what potentially is the right way to think. And that is most likely how a few of these groups have started, I imagine.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think looking at it now, I see my phase as a progressive Christian probably lasted for 4 or 5 years. And again, that was my step in deconstruction, because I started reading books by progressive Christian authors, even when I was still a pastor in Portland. And that was really eye-opening, because I was jettisoning a lot of my sort of fundamentalist beliefs. And I stayed in that, you know, period for, like I said, about 4 or 5 years. I couldn't sustain that, though, but it was a necessary step for me, just my own personal journey. I needed to get there in stages, you know, and eventually when I jettisoned all these pieces, I realized there was nothing left, but I couldn't have done that overnight. It took a journey of 4, 5, 6, 7 years to do that piece by piece and, you know, a little bit at a time.
It's amazing that was your particular experience as well, because a lot of people that I've spoken to who are going through those motions, once they have a conversation with somebody or once they realize that that is the process that they are going through, it's almost like, and actually something that Janice Selby spoke about during our conversation, is it's like a, I need to do it all now. I need to, you know, I need to get through this stage of deconstruction and get to the end and then get on with my life. And of course, it's a journey that will take a lifetime. And there's small things that have to happen, or, you know, it's a slow process to make sure that you're understanding all of those things in the ways that Janice so eloquently was able to express to us when we had her as a guest on the show. So it's interesting to hear your perspective of you not kind of realizing that that's what you were doing and you were going through those small stages that kind of enabled you to be where you are now. And that's really interesting. I haven't heard somebody speak about it in that way before.
I was going to say, I can see a kind of a historical parallel with the liberal theologians of the late 19th century, early 20th century. You know, they were trying to accommodate their Christian faith with, you know, modern science, basically, and evolution and higher criticism and all that. And that, I can see that's what, kind of a progressive version of Christianity. It's the same kind of thing, or a similar thing, where you're trying to hold on to your Christian faith, but you can't hold on to the sort of fundamentalist roots anymore. So something's got to give. And in my case, it was that what you just described. I mean, it was these little pieces that sloughed off, and I was still trying to hold on to the essence of what I considered the true beliefs of Christianity. And I think that's what a lot of progressive Christians do. They'll say, well, you know, we're more universalists. We believe that everyone's going to go to heaven and there's no hell, and we don't agree with a lot of the stuff in the Bible, and we, you know, we can be affirming of LGBTQ people and all the rest of it. And they go, well, that's kind of where I'm going to land. That's, and I can still stay a Christian. And you can do that. People stay there for the rest of their lives, and you have to accommodate somehow those sort of conflicting beliefs. But I wasn't able to do it. Eventually I had to jettison the whole thing.
On top of that as well, it's difficult when there are individuals who want to retain that spiritual connection, that belief system, but are members of marginalized or segregated community groups that are not always welcomed within high demand religious groups. But then there are even groups that we've talked about on this show, like Shincheonji, as an example of a group that positions itself as a progressive movement that is accepting of various community groups. And once a person is ensnared in some of the most bizarre cloak and dagger techniques that I've ever heard of on this show anyway, once somebody is in a position where they are funneled in and within the group, it's then like almost from, at least from the guests that we've had on the show, said to them, yeah, well, you know, we might have said that's our take on things, but actually we don't position ourselves that way whatsoever. And we're back to kind of having individuals that are just told that they can't be holy or spiritual in the way that other people are because of how they identify sexually. So that's just kind of me going off on a little side rant. But you said that you're still a teacher now, and it's my understanding that you teach down at Rees Heath College.
That's true, in Nantwich in England.
Nantwich is such a beautiful little part of the Northwest as well. It's like nice and countrysidey and country roads. And I mean, must be a bit of a drive for you though, if you
do that. About an hour's drive each way, but it allows me to listen to audiobooks and podcasts, you know, so I try to make the best use of the time.
And how did you find yourself in that particular role?
Well, that's another kind of long story, but the short version is, I was married at the time, and my wife at the time, her father was dying of cancer in the States. And so I started going over there to see her and see him, because she basically quit her job to go care for him full time. He had a brain tumor and he was dying. And so off the back of that, I started getting a lot of work over there in the Seattle area. This was about 4 years ago now. And I found myself going over there quite a bit, working, coming home, going back over they're working. And as a result, I lost a lot of the connections I had in this country for work, because I was a builder at the time. And when I came back after he passed away, I had no work. Nothing was lined up. So I thought, I better just get a real job. So I ended up landing this gig teaching carpentry and other, you know, building skills. So it just kind of organically happened in a weird way. And I'm a U.S. Navy veteran myself. So the fact that I teach these military vets is a really good connection, because I work for the college, but it's actually a charity that sends me these veterans. So a lot of them have PTSD, a lot of them have a lot of mental health issues. So in a weird way, I'm doing pastoral work, even though it's totally non-religious, I see myself still doing that kind of pastoral role.
It's incredible as well, because your platform offers the same thing. It's offering people a place to not only listen to you go through your own education, but also educating others through having those discussions on your podcast as well. So you really are still living in that space, and you weren't wrong when you said that life has kind of always pushed you towards that teacher position, because you're still there and you're living it now as well. And to hear that you're a US Navy veteran yourself is just like, what a wild journey you've been on. Yeah.
But I think that's a good perspective. Something I learned from a guy called John Atack, who's an ex-Scientologist. And he told me that, I'm sure you're familiar with his work. He lives in Nottingham, not that far from us either, but he said, you have to look at it this way. When you're reconstructing your life after leaving a religion or a high control group or whatever, you have to pick up those threads of the things that you learned while you were in that group, that's true to your own personality. So like, for example, talking about me playing drums or being a teacher, I learned all those skills when I was in the church. I learned academic skills. I learned how to research. I learned how to play the drums. I learned how to, you know, speak in front of a group. So I've picked up those pieces and said, okay, I'm going to keep that. I'm not a Christian anymore. However, it was not all universally horribly bad. You can pick up the positives and leave the negatives behind and work your way through that. I think that's part of the rebuilding journey as part of we, you know, this thing of reconstructing.
Those transferable skills.
Yeah.
That's definitely something to consider. And when I talk about the children's charity that I used to work for before I decided to do the podcast full time, it was a charity that works with young carers who support other family members in the home that need care and support. And these individuals are age 6 to 18. So sometimes it's a lot of responsibility to put on such a young person. And we always make a point of trying to harness those transferable skills that somebody might learn from caring for an individual, whether that's money management or making phone calls for deliveries and grocery shopping lists and all of these things that would come with somebody caring for another person at a young age, to actually apply that to things like CVs and volunteer positions and job skills when the children are a bit older, because a lot of the time academically they've fallen behind due to their caring role.
I think that perspective, it does take maybe years to get to the place where you can start to see, were there any positives? Because I can remember when I first left the church, I was so angry. And that's very common, isn't? You're angry, you're lashing out, you're pissed off, and rightly so. You were lied to, you were manipulated, you were abused, you were controlled, whatever the scenario might have been. And you can't see anything. You're just raging and lashing out on forums and, you know, Facebook groups and Twitter and everything else. But now I'm seeing, okay, the big sea change for me was that piece of reconstruction after deconstruction. I've done the deconstruction. I'm still doing it. But now I've got to rebuild my life, because that's the positive end of it. You say, I can't just stay in the rage and bitterness and anger forever. That's so unhealthy and toxic. A lot of people do, though, but it's not productive. You shouldn't sustain that for years and years and years. It's not good. So you've got to start putting the pieces back together or together in some productive way. It's hard to do. You might need therapy or counseling, but it should be done, I think.
And the Mind Shift podcast is a great place to go if you're on that journey or just interested in understanding what that journey might look like for individuals if you're not somebody who's currently experiencing that. And I know that this time is going down. I'll just sort that out again in a couple of minutes. Yeah. But for the next sort of 10 or so minutes, there are things that are particularly prevalent in the world right now as we have this conversation in terms of Christianity and dominionism. And this kind of comes back to our discussion around the Advanced Training Institute, the quiverful mentality around fundamentalism, the extreme evangelicalism that we're seeing come out of America, and the Roe versus Wade situation that's playing out in America right now as well. So for anybody that's not aware of what that is, could you just tell the listeners, Clint, what that situation is and how it's looking like it's going to unfold?
Well, as we're making this recording now, the judgment hasn't come down. The news is about this leak, isn't it, that's come out of the Supreme Court. And when this podcast airs, maybe there'll be an actual decision that's reached. But this is something that the Christian right has been working toward for decades. And the reason they want to overturn Roe versus Wade is their interpretation. It goes back to Christian nationalism. And their argument is that America, like I said before, was a Christian nation. It's kind of strayed from that path. It's lost the sort of righteousness that it had originally, the covenant with God. And because of sins like abortion and same-sex marriage and things like that, God is now, you know, cursing America. So we need to return to becoming a Christian nation again so God can bless America. The way, one way in which to do that is to overturn, to repeal Roe versus Wade, to make abortions illegal, and therefore God will start blessing America again. And this is the Christian nationalism is a lot of what's driving the move to put Supreme Court justices on that are conservatives during the Trump era, you know, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett. That was what was behind that. Once they got that majority, that's why these laws have just now come into play, because they knew they had the majority and they knew that it wasn't going to be repealed. And so this is all a long-term strategy that's been going on literally for decades. This is not a new thing. This has been going on for decades. So this is nothing new here.
What is the Roe versus Wade court case for anybody that hasn't heard of that trial before?
Well, as I understand it, it was a woman, I think it was a different name, wasn't it? But in 1973 is when the ruling came down that legalized abortion in all 50 states. And what their argument is now, I think with this leak, they're saying, when we overturn Roe versus Wade, we're going to kick it back to all the individual states. So we'll let the individual states decide whether or not they will legalize abortion in their particular home state. But one thing I just read on the news the other day, there's now 26 states, so virtually half the states, already have what they call trigger laws. So as soon as it gets repealed by the Supreme Court, immediately these 26 states are going to have these trigger laws that come into effect that are going to ban abortion. We've already seen it in Texas and Mississippi and other states. They've put in these super restrictive, draconian anti-abortion laws, and they're just waiting for the Supreme Court to pull the trigger on it. So it's going to be even worse, I think, than it is now in terms of when this actually does apparently get repealed by the Supreme Court.
So what are your anticipated consequences if this bill is passed through in terms of dominionism, the Christian right, female autonomy? What are some of the things that we might be facing here if America is to make this decision?
It's not good, is it? I mean, history just shows us example after example. Anytime, you know, a Christian religious group gets to have to be in charge of civic government, it's not a good thing. In fact, I've just got an episode coming out. It'll probably come out before this episode, but it's all about giving us historic examples of what happens in history when Christians are, in fact, in charge of the civil government. And so it's not a pretty picture. It becomes like a Handmaid's Tale type of existence. That might be a bit extreme, but it's actually not
that extreme.
Because it's these old white men, you know, that are telling women what to do and what not to do with their bodies. We're going backwards
in time. This is exactly what I was trying to explain to somebody yesterday. These are the themes and the events that took place leading up to the establishment of Gilead. And I know that Margaret Atwood wrote a dystopian novel of fiction, but maybe she kind of had a feeling, or, you know, she kind of understood the undertones of the potential for this to happen. We are going to look at the anti-abortion laws in line with the Quiverful mentality. It all seems to be playing into the same thing, which is that Christian fundamentalism takes over the world.
As you say, the Quiverful movement, that's the whole idea. It is a dominionist sort of angle. Let's just have as many kids as, quote, God allows us to have, and we'll eventually take over the world. So it goes along with, you know, guys like Rush Dooney, what he was preaching decades ago, the idea that if we just have enough Christian babies and raise them in this homeschooling or Christian school environment with a quote unquote biblical worldview, which is a dominionist worldview, eventually, it was a long-term strategy, we'll take over the world and usher in some sort of theocratic kingdom, Christ's kingdom on earth. And then perhaps then Christ will return. That's what a lot of them believe. We have to usher in that kingdom and then Christ will return. He can't return until that, you know, theocratic kingdom is set up. So that's what's driving a lot of this. And it always seems to be women who are on the receiving end of the worst of it. You know, I mean, you go back to Calvin's Geneva and Cromwell's England, and, you know, it was the women who were arrested for wearing too much makeup and immodest dress and, you know, all these other kind of things. This is all happening again. Where is it going to end? That's my question.
Terrifying. And I saw something the other day that said, if this bill gets passed through, if people think that segregation laws and LGBTQIA plus progression is safe. Nothing is safe. If this bill gets passed through, all bets are off for equal rights that we have managed to cover some ground on in the last couple of decades. Everything will just be reverted back slowly. And that is like, it just gives me goosebumps to think about the state that we might find ourselves in, you know, the next few years. Because we talk about progressive Christians, but of course, people that don't hold that worldview are not going to want progression at all. They're going to want to stay true to the fundamentalist values in the Bible that have no place for the LGBTQIA plus community, that for some time in some groups that we've spoken about don't have space for people that are, especially if you talk about white nationalism in Christianity, that don't have a place for anybody that is not white in skin color, which is really scary. And it, yeah, so I don't know, it feels post-apocalyptic, it feels dystopian, but it really is actually happening and unfolding as we have this conversation.
Well, like you say, there's the deep core of racism, which we didn't get into, I'm sure we don't have time now, but the real origins of the Christian right has its foundations in segregation academies in the South, you know, and that there's a lot of articles that have been written about. It's not about they were anti-abortion. That's what they want you to believe. They want you to believe that the second Roe versus Wade was passed in 1973, they said, hey, we've got to get organized and stop this thing. And we've been fighting it ever since 1973. That is not true at all. The Christian right was organized on the basis of an appeal to the racism, where they were like, the government's going too far in taking away our tax-exempt status for being a segregation academy. You know, government overreach, that's what we're pissed off about. And it was abortion that was the rallying cry that got the base motivated. You know, it wasn't really abortion, it was racism that appeals to these guys like Jerry Falwell and Bob Jones. That's where it really comes from. You know, and you find women of color, they are the ones who are getting targeted the most. You know, look at these gerrymandering and voter suppression laws that the Republicans are passing. It's typically these, you know, African-American neighborhoods where people live, that's where they're coming down the hardest. So it's racism at its very core. So much of it is.
And as you said, there is an agenda for almost every big Christian and political collaboration push in history. And you're able to just explain all of those and pinpoint all of those. And I feel like if anybody wants to know more, that's exactly what your podcast is going to be able to offer them. Your knowledge on this subject and your ability to just kind of reel off dates and names is astonishing to me. I'm so impressed by your level of knowledge. It's incredible. So before we round up today, something else that I read on your website, it says that we need to learn how to be proactive in this environment and not reactive. What would you say that means currently for anybody that's tuning in?
Well, as we said before, education is one of the biggest pieces, isn't it? And as we mentioned earlier, it's really, really hard to find objective reporting, whether it's media or whatever. But you can educate yourself on that, first of all, on that level of like the cult psychology, the deconstruction. There's a lot of really helpful books. We mentioned a few: Jen Senko, The Brainwashing of My Dad, Amanda Montell, Dr. Yanya Lalich, Dr. Marlene Winnell. These are fantastic resources. That's kind of like a first port of call, I think, to be able to name and sort of disempowers these tactics, that you can name them when you say, that was what was used on me to manipulate, to coerce, to control, to abuse me as a Jehovah's Witness, Scientologist, Christian, whatever the belief system you came out of. That's kind of one first port of call. And then books like Catherine Stewart and, like I mentioned, Sarah Posner, and so many other books that talk about the religious right, the history of it all. It's all there. You can unpack it all and start to see the historical context and what these people are doing now that's been going on for decades. So you, as they say on the X-Files, the truth is out there. You just have to find it and do your research, and not in a QAnon way, though. You have to find reputable authors who've done their research on these various subjects.
I love that line, disempowers these tactics used on me. That's amazing. Yeah. I feel like that is something that I've been trying to summarize in a sentence for a long time, and you've just, I'm going to be pinching that one for later use, I think.
You're welcome to use it. I probably stole it from somebody else.
I think that's an Oscar Wilde quote, isn't it? Genius, probably genius is. Steal.
Yeah.
So
I have nothing to declare but my genius or something like that.
For anybody that would like to find out more about you, your work, the projects that you've been involved in, your shows and your writing, where can people go to find more about Dr. Clint Haycock?
Well, probably the easiest way, just follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can also look up my public Facebook page. You can email me from that. You can just click the link and it sends me an email. If you want to chat, I can do it that way as well. My website is mindshiftpodcast.co.uk. So there's at least three ways. That's the easiest way to get a hold of me and find out. All my episodes are archived on the website, but I'm on, you know, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, all the major podcast platforms that I'm sure you're on as well.
Anybody that wants to check out Dr. Clint Haycock's work, they can follow the links in the episode description, and hopefully there'll be more coming up with me and Clint collaborating in the future. This is a shorter episode than usual, but I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to connect, and I feel like there's so much more to speak about, and I'm so thankful for you and your knowledge and your work, Clint. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Casey. I look forward to meeting you hopefully in person. We want to do an episode of Mindshift Podcast, so we're definitely going to work on making that happen.
Absolutely. That would be amazing. But enjoy the rest of your evening, Clint, and I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, Casey. Speak to you soon.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
That is the end of this week's episode. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram @cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, host of the Cult Vault Podcast.